This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and I want to start by welcoming our newest listeners from the Los Angeles area. We are so excited to join KCRW in Santa Monica and connect with all of you. Later in the show, we'll let you know how you can connect with me on social media and how you can join our listener response network, which is when we ask listeners a question a day through text message and play some of the responses we get on the next day's show. But we begin this hour with a look at our southern border and the impact we're seeing from President Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Under that policy, migrants who cross the border are apprehended, charged with a crime, detained, and separated from their children. To accommodate the growing number of children who need to be housed, the U.S. government erected a tent city that will house unaccompanied minors.
We're marching for our fathers.
We shall not be moved.
We're marching for our children.
Unity! Unity!
Unity!
Unity.
Yesterday on Father's Day, hundreds of people marched in Tornillo, Texas, near El Paso, to protest the tent city used to house both unaccompanied migrant children and minors who had been separated from their families. This march was part of the broader backlash against the Trump administration's policy that separates migrant children from their parents. Carlos Morales, Morning Edition host and reporter at Marfa Public Radio, is with us. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So you were at the protest at this so-called tent city. Can you tell us exactly where it is and what did you see?
Yeah, the so-called tent city, as you said, Tanzina, it's in the border town of Tornillo, Texas, which is about 25 miles southeast of El Paso, Texas. And there are, some officials have told us, Congressman Beto O'Rourke told me yesterday that he's heard from Health and Human Services that there are about 200 migrant boys. And when I arrived to the protest about an hour early, there were already cars lining up as far away as a half mile to a mile away from the port of entry just to get to this march.
Now, you mentioned boys. Where are the girls? We've been asking this question. I've seen lots of people ask the question.
Yeah.
Are we able to keep track of girls?
Right. So we have seen last week a bunch of, there have been reporters that have been able to tour some of the country's shelters and existing shelter space. And we know that this first temporary shelter site down in Tornillo is only boys. We haven't heard much from HHS, but we are hearing from different sources that girls are just in other shelters throughout the country. Now, which exact shelters, we're unaware of.
Who is running this facility specifically?
We haven't been able to get much detail on that, and I think that's these kind of questions that you'd imagine would be easy to find out have troubled and have bothered reporters and elected officials alike. It was U.S. Representative Will Hurd, whose district includes Tornillo, who's kind of lambasted this family separation policy. He's even decried the pains that he's gone through just to get a little bit of information.
Now, there is a little bit of back and forth from the Trump administration. Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen tweeted basically saying that there was no policy for family separation, quote unquote, period. Clarify, please.
Well, that's just not what we're seeing. That's not what, again, that's not what Will Hurd has heard, and that's just really not representative of what even her own department has said. It was just last week on a conference call with reporters that the Department of Homeland Security said that during a six-week period since April, there have been 2,000, more than 2,000 children separated from their families at the border. So that statement, that Sunday afternoon tweet, really kind of comes at odds with what's coming out of her own department.
Now, are there questions about how long these children are going to stay there? Again, we're hearing about a sheet of paper that's being given to parents as far as being able to contact their children. What can you tell us about what parents who have been separated from their children can do right now if they need to be reunited with them?
So HHS put out a quote-unquote fact sheet end of last week, and in it had instructions for how a parent might go about trying to figure out where their child is. And it's a phone number. You'd have to call collect, and when you call that number, sometimes it takes 10 minutes just for something to come up, and it rings and rings. And so it really again, I think this is one of those instances where there's just a lot of questions surrounding the structures in place for reunification and how that even happens. It's certainly one of the biggest questions that we have here out in Marfa.
Tell us a little bit also about the protests itself. Who was there? We're seeing reports of the occasional, you know, senators or congressmen trying to get in to get access to this. How much of that is a political stunt versus actually trying to get in, I guess, remains to be seen. But you were on the ground with protesters. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was there. And so this event kind of started. It was really spearheaded by Congressman Beto O'Rourke from Texas. But as we were arriving, you know, there were people wearing, you know, Beto O'Rourke shorts. But a lot of the people that were organizing the event asked them to turn that shirt inside out because they didn't want to make it seem like a campaign event. They wanted it to be more about family separations and the actual events happening at the border right now. So, you know, as I said, you know, Beto O'Rourke was an elected official that was there. So was Mary Gonzalez. She's a state representative, and her district includes Tornillo. And there were a couple of Democratic nominees who have races coming up in the fall.
But is there a sense, Carlos, that they're getting anything done? Because I feel like that's really the frustration. There's a lot of talking and nothing actually happening.
Yeah, I think that is part of the frustration, the frustrating point for them, rather. You know, the only people we've known so far that have toured that Tornillo facility are Will Hurd and Mary Gonzalez, both of whose districts includes Tornillo. And when they toured that site, you know, they said they were, or Mary Gonzalez told me that she was a bit surprised at the actual conditions of the facility. She thought they were much better than what she had imagined. She did say, however, though, that doesn't mean she's not against this. She's still calling for an end to family separations, but she said in that moment she felt that the children were safe.
Carlos Morales, Morning Edition host and reporter at Marfa Public Radio. Carlos, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tansina.
As outcry grows over the Trump administration's policy to separate undocumented immigrants from their children at the border, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen addressed the National Sheriff's Association in New Orleans earlier today.
There has been much outcry, consternation, and frankly, misinformation for many in the press, in Congress, and advocacy groups over the last few weeks that we at DHS are intentionally doing things that are unhumanitarian, that are cruel, immoral, and disgraceful. We aren't doing none of those things. We are enforcing the laws passed by Congress, and we are doing all that we can in the executive branch to protect our communities.
Secretary Nielsen pushing back against the criticism, saying that the department, quote, does not apologize for the situation. In the first month and a half that the administration's zero-tolerance policy was in effect, 2,000 children were separated from their parents. That figure came directly from the Department of Homeland Security. This, as more and more politicians have been speaking out against the separation policy. House Speaker Paul Ryan and at least two Republican senators are among them, as well as Laura Bush and Michael Hayden. So it's a tense backdrop. As the House turns to immigration this week, lawmakers are set to vote on legislation addressing family separation at the border. Rachel Bade is a congressional reporter for Politico.
You know, we're seeing from an increasing number of lawmakers on both sides of the aisle who are saying that they are uncomfortable with this policy and want to know more or are flat out asking the president to stop this now. We saw Democrats this weekend, a bunch of lawmakers showed up at the border demanding entry into these facilities where kids are being kept, wanting to know more and asking the president to stop. But Republicans are also saying that they don't know what's going on here and they want more information. GOP Senators Susan Collins of Maine, Jeff Flake of Arizona, both sent a letter yesterday to the Homeland Security Secretary asking, are people coming to the border asking for asylum being separated from their kids? If so, this is not what you said was going to happen when you were on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago. They're seeking clarity. They say they're really disturbed by these reports. And people are leaning toward addressing this. But the question is, how are they going to address this? Technically, the White House can just stop this policy, right? The president has tried to blame Democrats. But let's be honest here. That's very much hogwash, right? Republicans control the White House. They control the border policy right now. They control Congress. And so Republicans can stop this at any time. The question is, will the president do that?
Well, and we also saw a couple things since then. We've also seen former First Lady Laura Bush come out speaking about her concerns about this.
That's right. And I think that that's just going to add pressure. Melania Trump also has expressed a desire to want this policy to stop. But right now, what we're seeing is a bunch of finger pointing. Instead of owning up to it and owning up to the policy, we're seeing the president try to push off blame on Democrats. And that's particularly interesting because just a couple of weeks ago, I remember listening to a podcast where I was hearing Chief of Staff John Kelly actually make an argument for why the country needed to do this. And he was saying we need some sort of strong deterrent, and this will basically keep people from coming into this country that shouldn't be here. It'll stop them from coming. And so he was justifying it just a couple of weeks ago. Well, perhaps the pressure is one of the reasons why they're trying to push back now and blame someone else, or flat out deny it. You know, there was a tweet yesterday by the Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen, who said point blank, we do not have a policy of separating families at the border, period. Well, as you know, there's reporting to the contrary, but that does show that the pressure is increasing, but people are really going to have to dig down to get to the facts and, you know, hold people accountable and find out what's going on.
Beyond writing op-eds, beyond having conversations about this, beyond finger pointing, what is it that people are actually doing to make change here? Because as the finger pointing continues, we're seeing photographs of children in uniforms, photographs of children with numbers on them. So beyond the talk, what's actually happening?
And very disturbing, right? So on Capitol Hill right now, Republicans in the House are voting on two immigration bills this week. These are Republican bills. They basically, one of them includes a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, which obviously Democrats will like, but it also includes a whole bunch of immigration red meat policy issues, including, a crackdown at the border, a border wall with Mexico. One of them has a provision that would keep families together at the border. But here's the rub. A lot of folks are not going to like the solution that Republicans have come up with in the House. And basically, it's a policy where families, parents and kids would stay together, but the policy of detaining them indefinitely will continue, meaning children will be held indefinitely with their parents in cells in wherever they're being kept. So basically, they are being jailed with their parents. The ACLU has already pushed back on this policy, saying this is not the solution here. So this solution is something that's going to be controversial. I don't even think the bill passes the House. So beyond that, right now, the unfortunate thing is there is not a lot of action being taken. It's really in the questioning stage, and the solution that has been put out there is not going to be good enough for a lot of people.
Rachel Bade is a congressional reporter for Politico. Rachel, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
We turn now to Morristown, a small town of about 30,000 in eastern Tennessee, about an hour's drive from Knoxville. Gary Chesney has been a mayor there since 2015. He's a self-described conservative and Republican voter, a common position in the county where Trump won about 75% of the vote. But now Chesney finds himself in a tough position and on the front lines of the immigration debate. On April 5th, ICE, working with the IRS and the Tennessee Highway Patrol, conducted the largest workplace immigration raid in a decade in Morristown. About 100 people were rounded up, and more than 500 children missed school the next morning because many kids in the town were left without one of their parents, like this teenager.
I looked up to him, and then many things I do is for him because he's ill, and I just want to see him.
As the Trump administration ramps up everything from workplace raids to its zero-tolerance policy, Morristown is a microcosm of the debate that is playing out on the border and in small, often right-leaning towns like Gary Chesney's.
Immigration and undocumented immigration is a pretty hot-button topic and has been for a number of years in Morristown as that population, the Hispanic population, has gradually grown. Due to some of the job opportunities that were here in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a company in Florida that bought a large tomato farm, and they would bring the workers in and harvest the crop, and then they'd leave and come back, kind of a migrant worker situation. But they began finding winter jobs. There was some plants here that they just stayed, and the population kind of grew. So It wasn't that. I think what got people's attention were the breaking up of the families. There were a lot of children that were very traumatized, and I think that's what prompted the response by local folks.
Tell us a little bit more about how the community reacted. Were people taking in children who had been separated from their parents?
Well, HOLA, the HOLA group, it's a leadership group. Well, they kind of sprung into action. There's the local Catholic church had a facility where children who were suddenly, they were at school and coming to find out no one was at home, or family members who weren't coming home that night, and they had been detained, and it created quite a panic with a pretty significant segment of the school system. So folks who were family members and children gathered around the National Guard Armory, and there were lots of law enforcement presence and yellow tape and separating the family members from those who had been detained. And it was right next door to an elementary school, so that kind of jump-started a reaction where people began donating money and clothes and food. And some of the folks with HOLA had a couple of folks who are attorneys and went to, I think, got several students from UT Law School to come and start preparing legal work for power of attorney and things to where they could get children placed with family members and relatives so that everyone had a place to go. I think there were something like close to 600 children that did not show up for school the next day. And the school system responded as well to try to alleviate some of those fears.
I want to talk a little bit about the tension here. First of all, no one is arguing that the previous administration did not have problematic immigration policy, so I want to get that out. Now, this current administration, of course, has really changed its tone from the initial party of family values and the party that essentially was looking to, or at least the administration that was looking to really focus on what they called, quote, criminal illegal aliens. This policy is one that the president has directly enforced, has directly allowed to happen. As a Republican, Mayor Chesney, how do you reconcile those things? And this is obviously coming from rhetoric and the tone of the administration, which is one that has shifted pretty severely since this president was elected.
Well, I think, Tanzina, you've touched on it when you used the word rhetoric. Things that are said during campaigns and election efforts sometimes get toned down when after elections and the winner of elections is faced with the realities of the office that they've sought. So I think, yes, there is a tougher enforcement, I guess we could say, with immigration, but you have to separate fact from fiction sometimes from a hot election campaign to the everyday mechanics of applying rules.
Well, Mayor,
and
but
laws.
That's exactly what I'm suggesting right here, and that's exactly what I'm asking, is that the rhetoric set the tone for something that has now been completely targeted, and that enforcement that you're describing is really focusing on the most vulnerable, not undocumented immigrants with criminal histories, as was suggested during the campaign. But in fact, it's been very specifically targeted at Latino immigrants.
Right. And I think we should point out, I think there were 97 folks rounded up. Out of that 97, there were 10 where there were outstanding criminal warrants discovered to be in place. And another 37 who had been deported previously and snuck back into the country. And then the others were their cases come before immigration judicial system.
So are you suggesting that's okay then? I mean, for the folks who, let's say the numbers that you're describing, you know, are still a small percentage compared to the overall and compared to the policies that we're seeing today, which are directly impacting and separating families.
I think it's a complex issue, and I think we all get a little bit smarter about how to handle complex issues when they land close to home. I feel like Morristown handled this situation probably better than what the folks in D.C. are handling a similar situation in the southwest border. We've had an experience here that we hadn't had before. I guess what stands out in my mind is the undercover person that the IRS put in the meatpacking plant asked some of the undocumented, well, you all live in Morristown, why aren't you working there? And the response was, well, we can't get jobs there, or they find out we're undocumented, we're either terminated or not hired. Well, I thought, well, good for us, we're following the law. At the same time, when we had lots of trauma and crisis with children and spouses, the response that we made of compassion was another good for us. So I felt like overall we've dealt with this in a fashion that hopefully might set an example for others.
Gary Chesney has been the mayor of Morristown, Tennessee since 2015. Mayor Chesney, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Hey, thanks for checking out the Takeaways podcast. I know there are like hundreds of podcasts out there, so we really appreciate you choosing ours. And if you like what you hear, why not help spread the word? Like I said, a lot of podcasts, and you leaving us a rating or a review on iTunes will definitely help us stand out from the pack. Thanks in advance. Now back to the show.
It's been a difficult few weeks in Guatemala after the Fuego volcano erupted earlier this month. More than 100 people have been killed, and 200 people are still missing. In the midst of all this, Guatemala's government is quietly trying to pass a highly unpopular bill. It would give amnesty to members of the military accused of atrocities, including genocide and torture, during the 36-year-long civil war from 1960 to 1996. Jo Marie Burt joins us to explain. She's a professor at George Mason University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America.
So this bill was introduced in the fall, October, November of last year, and it essentially proposes to revise an existing law, the Law of National Reconciliation, which was created after the peace accords were signed. And that law establishes a series of things, but most notably is the law establishes amnesty for political crimes, but it excludes certain types of international crimes. Genocide, torture, and forced disappearance, crimes against humanity, are excluded from the amnesty provisions, which means that the Guatemalan prosecutor's office has full authority to move forward and investigate, prosecute, and punish those responsible of those crimes. Now, what the law is proposing is to strike those exclusions from the legislation. In other words, it wants to create a blanket amnesty for all actors engaged in the internal armed conflict. And the language of the law proposed revisions states that the guerrillas would also benefit from these amnesty provisions. So they're trying to create a kind of equivalence, but 93% of abuses were committed by state forces. And the Truth Commission found that 3% were committed by guerrilla forces. So there are, in fact, some crimes for which guerrilla forces have been prosecuted and could be prosecuted in the future. They're trying to create an equivalence to make it seem like it's fair and in an effort to bring forth national reconciliation.
What's your expectation for this bill in particular? Because it's coming at a time when Guatemaltecos are still essentially putting their lives back together.
Right. I mean, I do think the timing is, you know, it's not a coincidence. I think there's an effort to take advantage of people being distracted by this terrible tragedy of the volcanic eruption to push forward a bill that is, by all counts, both unconstitutional and in violation of Guatemala's international obligations. But it reminds me of what happened in 2013. So when in 2013, Guatemala put on trial the former dictator, Efraín Ríos Montt, who was, by the account of the Truth Commission, under his government was the most violent period of the internal armed conflict. Hundreds of villages were simply decimated. And he was put on trial along with his intelligence chief, for those crimes. And he was found guilty of genocide and convicted to 80 years in prison. And within 10 days, the Constitutional Court stepped in, determined that there had been a due process violation, and partially suspended the proceedings, which in effect vacated the verdict. And that was the result of intense pressure by military and economic elites calling on the Constitutional Court to overturn that verdict. So I think what we're seeing again is politicians and the military trying to interfere in the court's activities to guarantee impunity. We've seen this movie before in Guatemala, and it's my hope that the coalition of forces who are promoting accountability and rule of law and justice for victims will prevail and stop this bill from becoming law.
Jo Marie Bird is a professor at George Mason University and a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Wow. So I know a lot of you are feeling exactly the way I am. You're tired, you're stressed, you're in need of a vacation. You feel like you're running out of time. There's long hours. You don't have a lot of personal time. And there's a constant sense of always trying to catch up to everything, to check your messages, to stay on top of the news. And to be honest with you, we have to do something about this. I need a break, and I think we all need a break. And Bridget Chilty is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. She's going to help us figure this out. And she's also the host of the new podcast, Better Life Lab, that looks at the division between work and leisure time. And she joins us now from Japan. Bridget, please help us out. I'm overworked. You're overworked. Many of our listeners are overworked.
What you're describing is such a universal feeling for so many people, feeling that they just don't have enough time in a day to do everything they need and want to do, feeling like work slips into the evening, work slips into the weekend. It never seems to end, and you never seem to get any time to do anything else. You know, and that's really universal, whether you're a knowledge worker or whether you're a low-wage worker. It's a really modern predicament that we find ourselves in America. You know, all of the surveys show that whether you call it work-life balance or work-life integration or work-life fit or work-life harmony, whatever you want to call it, people really yearn for it. And why is that so hard? Why are we not able to feel that consistently? And so that's what we're really trying to do with the Better Life Lab podcast is really explore, we call it the art and science of living a full life, just because I hate to use the word work-life balance.
Well, I guess what we're saying is it's almost, there is no such thing these days. There's a feeling of you can never focus, right? There is, you constantly have something in the back of your mind. And I feel like that takes away from our quality of life, right? Not really ever being able to really, I mean, we talk a lot about mindfulness, but I find that most people find it hard to be mindful in any way because of this sense of overworked.
It's really true. Or this, you know, the sense of always being busy. You've always got so much on your mind. You're thinking about things, you're worrying about things, you're trying to keep track of things. There's a wonderful term that psychologists and social scientists use. It's called contaminated time. And that's where you could be in an activity that looks like leisure, or you could be at your desk looking like you're working hard, and yet you are so lost in your thoughts, you're kind of everywhere and nowhere. And what you're really describing in sort of modern life with all of this, you know, 24/7 globalization, high tech coming at you all the time, is our cognitive bandwidth is really stretched thin.
And I also wonder if it, I mean, at least for me, I find that I spend a lot of time doing everything, and what tends to suffer are my interpersonal relationships because there just isn't time.
And, you know, that's one of the saddest things, is because we know from happiness research that real human happiness, the source of human happiness, is our connection with other people. You know, and there have been heart studies and health studies, and the people who not only live the longest but feel the most fulfilled, you know, it wasn't the great success at work or some, you know, big prize that they won. it's usually the quality of the relationships that they have. And I think that's something that we all really need to keep in mind, is that when we feel that our days are full and our calendars are really full and you can't possibly cram another thing onto your to-do list, you almost need to create that space, put that on your to-do list, that making time for friends, making time for those deep connections, not just an email, not just a like on an Instagram post, but real time to connect with another person.
Well, I think I definitely want to get into the solutions. Listeners, we know some of you are also feeling overworked. And if you are, we'd love to hear from you. Tweet me at Tanzina Vega, tell me about it, or tweet us at The Takeaway. I want to get back to the impact that this that overwork can have on a person. And in your upcoming podcast, we have a Stanford business professor who actually said something I would love our listeners to hear.
And it turns out almost all of the workplace practices we looked at, economic insecurity, absence of health insurance, long work hours, shift work, absence of job control, had health effects as large as secondhand smoke.
So are we basically saying overwork can kill you?
That's exactly what Jeff Pfeffer is saying. He worked with some other economists, and they did a meta-analysis of more than 200 studies looking at work and sort of work conditions and stress, and then the illnesses and sickness and even death that can result from work-related stress. And what they've come up with is, through their analysis, is that simply the way that we work, long work hours, a feeling of whether you're in control or not of your work and your workload, if you have an erratic schedule, if you have a toxic boss or a toxic work environment, those kind of softer things. We're not talking about, falling off a ladder or working in a coal mine, but just simply the work environment itself has become the fifth leading cause of death in the United States.
Well, and I also think there's an idea of weakness, right? If we, particularly when it comes to things like mental health, the assumption is the person might be weak. And if we're not working ourselves to death, if we take time to say, you know what, I need a quote unquote mental health day or just a day or a couple of hours, then there isn't a lot of empathy, I guess, collectively in the American psyche for that.
Well, that is one of the key points that we're really trying to take on, not just at the Better Life Lab podcast, but just the work that we're doing at the Better Life Lab. It's really taking on that notion of the ideal worker. And we do have a very powerful notion in this country that the ideal worker works all the time, never gets sick, never gets tired, doesn't have any caregiving responsibilities, which is basically nobody. You know, when we talk about putting in all these long work hours, there are also really good studies that show there is a lot of wasted time at work. You know, Bain and Company did this fantastic, fantastic study, and they found that the average middle manager in the United States puts in 6 hours a week of sort of concentrated, meaningful work. And the rest of the time is taken up with emails and meetings and kind of like busy
politics.
And so, when we think about rewarding these long hours, a lot of times we're rewarding really inefficient work.
Now, obviously, a lot of our listeners will say, that sounds great, Bridget, but I can't just stop my job. So what do we do? What are some actual tangible things that people can do when they feel either overworked or that they have no control over whether they're overworked?
Right. Well, I think the very first thing to do is just take that moment to stop and really think about what is the most important thing in that moment, and not just at work, but in your life, because there can be a time when, there's just all sorts of stuff happening in your home life that can be really distracting at work. So we need to stop thinking about those in separate, sort of like work is the only thing that's important today. We need to think about all of those spheres and what is most important. And there shouldn't be more than maybe three things on there.
And with a collective sigh of relief, I'd like to thank you. Bridget Schulte is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, author of Overwhelmed, Work, Love, and Play When No One Has the Time. And she's also the host of a new podcast, Better Life Lab. Bridget, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And that's our show for today, but we want to leave you with an exciting discovery in the animal kingdom. Last week, scientists were able to capture the clearest sound recordings of narwhals so far. These so-called sea unicorns are elusive mammals that dive thousands of feet down into the Arctic Ocean to hunt. But that's made it really hard for scientists to study how they communicate, until now. Now, we still don't know what these narwhals are gossiping about, but these cryptic recordings will help researchers study the impact of human sounds on marine animals underwater.
Bye, buddy. Hope you find your dad.
Thanks, Mr. Narwhal.
And thanks so much to you for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.